We would continue with our introduction to distributed applications. And the last thing we talked about was basically that we started with inter-process communication. And one of the things, how we could distinguish it, it's on the type of communication, either on an asynchronous way that the sender and the receiver behave in an independent way, or in a synchronous way that basically sender and receiver are synchronized. Then on the other hand, you have operations for the sender to send and for the receiver to receive the message. And that you can do as a blocking or a non-blocking approach. Blocking means sending, and then the sender is blocked until either the message is received by the receivers or even in some point the request contained in the message is basically executed. But if we look at it, we can hear, as I mentioned before, the basic functionality with send and receive. With send, you specify the receiver. That can be also a group of receivers in case multicast, and on the other hand, the sender, which basically here the receive operation, which is basically executed by the receiving entity, you can also have something like S as a star, and that means the receiver waits for a message from any sender. And that's typically what you have here on server side, where you don't really know from which client message will be received. If we, the other thing is, we can distinguish different perspectives, either from the sender perspective or either from the receiver perspective. And from the sender perspective, we can then look at the synchronous or asynchronous behavior. And if we look at it, we especially here with a non-blocking behavior, when we look at the sender perspective, here we have something like a message system. And the message system, be it called NP, and it's usually the message system part of the operating system, and the sender basically provides the message to the message system. There, it's put into the message buffer or the message queue, and then the sender can basically continue, and it doesn't have to wait until the message is received by the appropriate receiver. And message buffer, the size of NP can be larger, can be one or larger than one. If it's one, then basically the sender can only send one message and then has to wait until the message disappears from the message buffer. Or if the message buffer is larger than one, then basically multiple messages can be triggered by the sender and it can still continue on. Therefore, you have a lot more parallelism if you have a larger message buffer. An important aspect is the message buffer here. It's managed, also here, managed by the operating system. And that is done, first of all, by that messages can't be tampered. And because if it would be something like a general application type of service where everybody has access to, then arbitrary other processes might have access to it and might change messages. And therefore, the intent is that messages maintained in the message buffer are basically managed by the operating system to provide some level of protection against modification. The sender provides the send, and the receiver, there we have we provide a receive operation, and we have something like a passive notification. And that means here repeated execution of receive by the receiver. And that means it would always check, is there already a message for me available, or if not, it would possibly have some, it would wait, or it has something like a time limit associated with it. If within a certain time limit no message comes, it would return with an error message. The other thing is you could have something like an active notification. And there you have two variants. Variant one, the receiver provides a data structure and the message is basically copied into the data structure. So here, received message is copied in data structure of receiver. And therefore, the receiver basically could check at arbitrary time if the data is available. The main difference with respect to receive and the data structure is here. The data structure is in the address space of the receiver. Therefore, the data are already within the receiver's responsibilities. Here, if it does a receive, it always has a system call into the operating system. Therefore, here there's no operating system system call necessary. It's basically just look at its own address space. The other variant is the callback of a function, and that means the receiver basically registers a callback function, and if the message communication system receives a message for that receiver, and if that message is then received completely, then it would invoke the call with a callback, the function, and then typically provides in the parameter of the callback the message content as well as, I mean, the whole message, because then it would also specify the sender and all the additional metadata of the message. That's basically the different types which are available. An example here, just a simple thing. Here we have the message system, and that's then the message buffer, and that's here part of the of the OS, the operating system. And if we have a distributed environment, that means that message system is distributed across multiple systems. As here, maybe distributed across multiple systems. And that would mean we have something, a message system on the sender side. We have then the routing facilities in between. And then we have the message system on the receiving end. And here, that's basically an example of a passive notification. And because here it performs a receive, then possibly here it gets, because the data are not available yet, it gets an error message that no message is available, and then at a later point in time it would execute another receive. And in that sense, this is system call here, system call here. The other thing, what we can look at it, advantages and disadvantages. Advantages, certainly we can say the sending process is not blocked. Therefore, it's appropriate, for example, for real-time applications, because the sender is not really blocked when it initiates a sending or a message sent. On the other hand, you also have then a possibility of parallel execution. Very often it is used for event signaling purposes, because there are also a number of disadvantages. Certainly, if you have this asynchronous behavior, you have to do a management of the message buffer. And the message buffer accepts a certain amount of messages or a certain size. And if you have a buffer overflow, you have to handle that. And at some point, the message system would not accept any new sends anymore. And then it would block basically the sender. You would have access control to avoid any modification of messages. And therefore, in that sense, I mentioned before, we basically put the inter-process communication. Usually, it's very often part of the kernel, of the microkernel, and it's therefore protected by the operating system. And the other thing is also, well, if the receiver crashes, then you have messages in the message buffer which can't be delivered. And what do you do with that? And do you keep them, or do you at some point throw them out? And then you would have the situation that you have to notify the sender in case of a failure. And that's here the question where you have, where should S be continued after an error notification? And you can just look at the situation here. If you have here the time, if we have here the time, and that's S, and here it basically makes the send. And then it would continue on. And here, at some point, it gets the error message. And the point is here, it executed now already a number of operations. And the point is here, well, do you do something like a rollback? Go back and try to send the message again, possibly with a modified parameter or with a modified receiver, because possibly you get the message back, well, the server is not available because it crashed. You try to do a different binding to send the request to an alternative server. And therefore, what do you do? Do you do a rollback, go back, and send it to an alternative server? Well, in the meantime, you might have already done another send here. And therefore, you have a lot of problems if you do a rollback. And because it would also mean do something like an unsend to all these ones, because you do it again with something like modified parameters. And therefore, in that sense, if you do a modification here, it might have as a consequence modifications to the parameters or to the message you sent here. Therefore, another alternative is here to do something like an uncommit to all the messages you sent to all the other servers. A third alternative is that you find usually something like exception handling. And now you put everything into the responsibility of the programmer to decide what should we do when something like an exceptional situation occurs. And now the programmer has to decide, well, how to do the exception handling. And therefore, it can then decide, well, these ones, that's okay, or it has to do something appropriate with it. But what I wanted to show that the handling of errors might be rather complicated in an asynchronous situation. And the same thing you have here, design of the correct system is rather difficult because it depends on the buffer sizes, because the message system is not used only by one process. The message system is used by many processes which run in the environment of the sending process. Therefore, you have different situations with respect to load, with respect to interaction between processes. Therefore, you have a lot of uncertainties. You run the system, no problem occurs. You run it the next time, then you have a problem, and that makes it then very difficult to find errors. And also with the message propagation delays and things like that. Therefore, the tendency is usually to look at something like synchronous, because here you have the situation that you have here the sender to be blocked. Therefore, here it's suspended. Here you do a receive. The receiver is suspended, and we can say here the request is received, but not processed yet. Therefore, in that sense, when the sender is unblocked, I mean, here again, we have the message system in between, and like the inter-process the communication system from the in the local environment as well as a distributed environment. But here, when the unblocking occurs, the sender can be sure that the message is received by the receiving end, that it was not lost due to a buffer overflow or lost by the by something like a router in between. Therefore, in that sense, it can be pretty certain that it's received. The problem what you might have an infinite blocking. So here, infinite blocking when receiver is not up and running, because here it can't be it's not received. Therefore, an acknowledgement is not triggered back to the sender. Therefore, what you do is you somehow decouple here sender and receiver, and you have something like a timeout. Here, if you don't, if the sender does not get an acknowledgement, it has a timeout, and then the sender can decide: does it go to an alternative receiver and server and send the message to the alternative sender? It might send it again to the same receiver, because it could be that the message was somewhat lost in between. And usually what you can do and what you do nowadays is to use threads, and that's exactly what's then used, what we call this remote invocation send. Therefore, for each send request, basically the sender would trigger a new thread, and the thread would basically wait until the message is received by the receiver. Here it's received and processed. Therefore, in that sense, you have now the situation: the sender, you have the receiver, you sent the message here, it's sent, it's processed here, and then you have here the answer message sent back to the sender, and here the thread is basically blocked. And that's exactly what you typically have in client-server paradigms. And therefore, on the server side, you're always pretty certain that the message was then received, the request was received. I mean, here sent, that's basically the request. It was received, it was processed. That also means you have a check if the parameters and the message content, the request content, was okay. If it was not okay, the answer message would be basically an error message sent back by the server. And if it was okay, then you get the appropriate result as part of the answer message. The in that sense, the answer message is an acknowledgement that the message was basically received correctly. The other thing is, the problem what you might have is, if you have, let's say, multi-tier architectures, and you have a send here. I mean, here you have a request, then you have a server here. So here that's S1, then here S2, that sends here, because of that message, another request on to this one, and then it comes back, and it comes back to this one. Therefore, in that sense, you might have a long delay until the final result comes back. On the other hand, if we talk about threats, if we have here the S1 in as a threat programming, then the one individual threat might be blocked, but all the other threats of S1 are not blocked. The tendency, therefore, in that sense, asynchronous message exchange is not very often used anymore. It's basically used for event signaling and not really for request answer messaging. Because of all the problems of the asynchronous behavior in handling situations, where do I progress when an error occurs and so on, and all the buffer handling. Therefore, usually what you find is requests invocation sent, but now on a threat level. And previously it was a lot of effort. How do we do to handle asynchronous message exchange? And then basically the mechanism of threats came up, and it's basically available in any programming language as well as operating system environment. Therefore, in that sense, the asynchronous behavior is only used in event signaling. Otherwise, it's not used in that way anymore. The only thing is here, you might have a problem like a cyclic blocking state. Therefore, you have to avoid something like a deadlock. Because if you think here, if you have first S1, S2, and now you just think of here, this one as part of the processing would try to make a request to this here, to the same threat. And that threat does not really answer because it's blocked. And therefore, in that sense, you have to be careful how you handle then incoming requests, that you don't really use the same threat which did the request sending here. Basically, you have to use another threat to handle receiving or incoming requests. And if you do that, then you should not have any problems. Good. Then let's look at an important aspect is naming. We can think of the situation that we say certainly we have an entity. And an entity can be a resource, can be a service, or can be a hardware or software resource. And on the other hand, the situation is, how do we access it? Certainly, we can use an address. And an address would be basically something like an access point of an entity. And the problem is the address of an entity might change, especially if you think of mobile environments, like your mobile phone might migrate from one environment to the other environment. The same thing is also, if you look at a laptop, it might migrate from one network environment to the next network environment. Therefore, in that sense, the address might change. And therefore, what you would like to have is something like a name, and the name basically would not change. It's basically the same. And therefore, in that sense, you would have something like a resolution, and the name resolution would be the address of the entity, how you access this. And the name then basically refers to the entity. And with the name resolution, you have something like a mapping from the name to the address. Additionally, we have something like an identifier. And an identifier, it's basically a name which uniquely identifies an entity. And therefore, we can say an ID refers to at most one entity. And the other point is an ID, it always, and we can always say an ID always refers to the same entity. And that means an ID is not reused. So here, ID is not reused. Here, a regular name, you could actually reuse it. If you say, well, it was used for a resource or for an entity, the entity basically goes away, it does not exist anymore, and then you can have something like an information that the name is free, and then you could reuse the name again, but that's not really acceptable for an identifier. Therefore, an identifier, even if the entity is not available anymore and basically disappears, then you would have something like an ID, but the ID could not be matched to the appropriate entity anymore. The other thing is for the names, how you manage these names, you can have, they are typically organized hierarchically. In that sense, you might have what we call a global layer. And if you think of organizations or the whole internet, it's basically on that level, on whole organizational level. You would have something like an administrational level or administrational layer. That would be something like a single organization. Here you would have something like all org organization. Here a single org. That's what I meant before when you think of the whole internet environment. Or you could have something like what it's called a managerial layer. There's a managerial layer. That would be then something like a department. And the distinction is especially relevant for a large organization. If you have a small company where you have only 50 or 60 people and you have only one local network, then basically the administration layer as well as the managerial layer is basically identical. And from the file systems, you might have absolute or relative path names, and especially if you look at XML, you have the possibility of XPath, and you can use XPath basically to identify entities or resources, and they can be unique or they can be basically relative in a sense where it depend on a context where you apply them. And in that sense, you have a global name or a local name. The name resolution, as I mentioned before, you can have either there are multiple possibilities. Like one of the things is LDAP, which is here used in at TUM or TUM Online. Basically uses as well as all the other things around Moodle and so on. They use LDAP name services to match names to people, to match names to resources, and so on, as well as services. You could also have, if you look at the internet level there, you can use the domain name services and how it's handled. Certainly in domain name service, DNS, you have something like cooperating name servers. We don't have one name server. You have many name servers, but we have a domain name service, and therefore, in that sense, the the local name server, domain name server, is contacted. Can it resolve that name? If it can resolve that name, it immediately returns the address. If it cannot resolve it, then it contacts some well-known name servers. If they are capable of resolving their names, if these contacted name servers can't do it, they would contact their known partners and so on, and then until it goes up, until you come to the root name servers, and that the root name servers would contact the appropriate other partners or name servers and so on, until you come to one which basically is capable of resolving that name, and then it could be recursively sent back to the originating name servers. You could have the other situation that you don't do it recursively, that the client contacts its name server. This one does say, well, I can't do it, but try it with that one. Then the client contacts this one, and then this one can't do it. It comes back with an alternative name server and so on. Therefore, the client always contacts the appropriate name server. Therefore, in that sense, it's not done recursively. It's done always that you get information back and then contact alternative name servers. This is the example here, and the next thing is we can quickly look at it. What we already talked about, this request answer scheme, and an important aspects is our sockets. Sockets were originally developed at Berkeley University as part of the Berkeley Unix variation, and it's application created, but it's an operating system controlled interface. And it basically abstracts technical details of underlying network. And it was a big advance in programming network communication. Before, the programmers had basically to program, let's say, TCP messages, and that's rather, error prone, because you have all these meta information of TCP messages. And that's now basically abstracted using sockets. And you have in all different languages, be it C, be it Java, be it some other languages, you have sockets available and use it for programming. And what you get is you get something like the request answer scheme in a sense of an output stream and in an input stream on the client side as well as on the server side. And therefore, in that sense, this one sends messages into the output stream, and it basically gets messages via the input stream. You use TCP level of addressing, and therefore, in that sense, you use the IP address as well as the port number. And if we look at, for example, what you get from Java, you get from the package a whole bunch of methods. How do you create a socket? Certainly here an unconnected socket, or you can provide an address and the appropriate port number. You can also provide a proxy if you already have had previous use the communication, for example, via a proxy, and the proxy is basically matched to the appropriate address and port number. Or you could provide a host name and then a port. And if you have a host name, you need then something like name resolution. Here, in the uppercase here, if you provide that, you already have the address of it. Then you have here the bind. That's basically, I'll bind it to the local address. Here, connect binds it to the server. That's here on the remote side. And here you can also attach a timeout if you basically don't get if you can't get a connect, then you get out of the method after a certain waiting time, and you close it here on that end. We can look at an example, just a quick example to look at it, and especially here it's client perspective. What you have here is client, server. Here it's a request. So what we do is a send string, come to the server, and then we have echo string. Therefore, in that sense, here we don't really do anything. And how the thing is handled here, we have here the host, pick here the host name, and here the port. We create a new socket. Certainly, usually, if you do an application level port, you don't use 7 because the first 1,000 ports are reserved. And usually you use a port beyond 10,000 as on the application level. Then you have here something like a writer. That's the output stream. That's a writer. And that's here the reader stream. Then you might have the situation here. You have a try. If the host name can't be resolved, you have here something like an exception. We can also go then down. What we do is the here, this is a generic exception IO problem. If you don't a connection to it, here you have a standard in. That's what you do is you read user input. Here you send it to server. Here, send to server. And then what you have here is receive it, receive from server. And here you just print it out on your screen. And then here you close the output stream, you close the input stream. And basically, and here you close the socket. I mean, here you close the two streams, here then you and finally close the socket. And that's basically a simple way of programming it. Thank you very much. And then